Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
So do you have a plan for today?
I don't really have a plan for any day, you know. Yesterday I wanted to do a piece for Dependent Press, which is just an online zine. And the first person I thought of was you to feature. And we usually do music on that zine, but it just came to me that I'd really like to do a piece on Jason. I actually spent a lot of the morning just kind of soaking up a lot of liminalist things and just kind of watching and reading about kind of doing my homework, you know, because I really didn't come into it with a plan exactly, other than just to kind of, you know, try to spread the things you're saying and the things you're doing. You know, I kind of think that they're important, and the people I know don't know who you are, so you know, my plan is to just get more people to know about what you're doing and kind of give you a chance to explain in your own words what it is so that it's not misconstrued, you know?
Okay, yeah. That's always a challenge.
Well, yeah, I don't want to make it challenging. I kind of just...
Well, because you know about me because I came to you because of French radio, who's a very kind of obscure internet presence. So once I discovered his music, I was trying to track him down, and that led me to your site. And so, I mean, that's clearly the overlap between what you do and what I do, because one of the aspects of the podcast that I consider liminal is finding these musicians who are in the margins, who don't charge for their music and don't really self-promote, but just do it.
And
to bring that music to my listeners.
Right.
Which is kind of what you're doing with your thing as well, is finding marginal voices and amplifying them. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there's a huge community of very talented and very sincere artists on, you know, mainly SoundCloud is where I hover, but, you know, it's not hard to really find. I could do an article a week if I had the, you know, wherewithal, but, you know, I mean, these people, I don't think they're getting enough attention, and the people that are on SoundCloud that are getting a lot of attention, I figure they already have it, so they don't need it. So I'm kind of like rooting for the underdog, you know, because that's kind of what I am. Like, I make stuff and do production work, but really, I don't care if I'm popular, you know what I mean? It's not about popularity, but it helps when somebody kind of will, you know, you network with people and you kind of give them a little bit of exposure, you know? But but enough about that. I really found interesting this morning your 18 things I wish I were told when I was 18.
Right.
How long ago did you produce that?
That was for my niece's 18th, so that she's just turned 19, so that would have been just over a year ago.
Okay.
I threw that together. It came with a book as well. I made a book with two copies, one for her and one for me. And
oh, okay.
It's kind of an example of what I think creativity can be outside of this thing about popularity
and ego.
Or status or reputation or influencing people or being a spokesman or any of these other things, which aren't necessarily bad, but
yeah. They're
not. They've kind of got inextricably bound up with the creative thing and the creative identity, as opposed to what it used to be, and what I guess it is for millions of people who just do little stuff at home. They paint paintings or do little montages or collages or whatever,
yeah.
And they don't really expect anyone to see it or require them to.
Right.
And that, as people who do it know, it's very, very satisfying just to be in that brain state of being creative and expressing things.
Yeah, I agree.
But then that gets, if you do want to use that as currency to get the world's attention, then that can add this element of real frustration to it. So this was a kind of in between. I was definitely doing it for an audience, but it was an audience of, you know, one or two people, and so it was, yeah, it was a total success.
Yeah, well, I would that's, you know, something I would share with people. It almost seems to me like people, they don't, like, nobody wants to pay you or see you successful until you're dead, and then it's okay to, like, you know, take your art and make money off of it, you know.
I just read something about that, and it wasn't about artists, about scientists, but how when scientists make new discoveries, they're generally resisted, them and the discovery, until after they're dead, and then once they're dead, the scientific community starts to take them on.
Yeah, I think so. there is something behind that. If you look at a lot of influential people, right, you know, like Nietzsche or Van Gogh, you know, they were not popular and they died like insane and lonely, and, you know, now they're household names and really, you know, big with pop culture, you know, and I think that's a good example of how people treat each other. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I obviously knew about the Van Gogh syndrome and all that, an artist who's unrecognized in his own time, but it was the first I'd heard about it as a phenomenon. I mean, it's always been about the artist being ahead of his time. That's been the cliche about that. Whereas this, in the scientific community, well, I guess you could say it's that, but they're specifically saying once the person is dead, and then people accept the idea. So it seems as though it has something to do with a community or a group finding that new voice threatening in some way, not simply because of the nature of what it's communicating, but just the fact that it's one of them communicating something new, and that somehow threatens, it threatens egos is an obvious interpretation, but I think there's probably something more fundamental there. If you have a member of the group who is transmitting something new within the group, that threatens this cohesion of the group, not just because of what they're transmitting, but just the fact that one of them is different.
Right.
And because in a group, when one individual voice is very distinct, the usual thing is for that voice to get scapegoated, like Jesus.
Right.
Because that's syndrome. How the group... Yeah, that's how it was, the scapegoat mechanism.
Sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, we'll go... This is a very deep, broad subject in terms of if you want to be an innovator... and at the same time be noticed by your community or group, chances are you're not going to benefit from getting noticed. Chances are, if you're really innovative, you will be seen as disruptive, and scapegoated and whatnot.
Yeah, I was watching a few documentaries yesterday, and the same thing with Martin Luther King. You know, he was a civil rights leader of the country with FBI protection, and once he started speaking out against Vietnam, he was ostracized, and that's when he got murdered, you know, just because he was speaking out against, you know, the power infrastructure, you know. But before that, he had FBI protection. Right.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, interesting.
I mean, didn't know that first, but a bit about the protection though.
Yeah, apparently that's, you know, at least from the the you know, stuff I've been watching lately. That's the information I've been getting.
Yeah, well, I think in terms of the music industry or the arts industry too, there's a I think there's a, I mean, we talked about this with French radio. Did you listen to my conversation? Yeah, you must have.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We talked about that a while ago, but yeah.
Yeah, about how the music industry functions as a kind of cartel, and in order to get ahead in the industry requires tacit agreement to follow the guidelines and follow the principles that the music industry itself,
right,
you know, that depends on to survive. It was difficult. It's always difficult to talk about because I'm not an insider, so I don't have success to draw upon for experience. But it does seem as though there's a kind of implicit order to capitalism and to the system, that filters like voices, so that I think of how, you know, popular musicians now literally filter their voice in order to become homogenous. But anyway, it's kind of, that's kind of metaphorical. You have to filter your voice as a individual,
right,
so that it will be compatible with the system that then will amplify it. And if you don't allow these filters to be put on your voice, you won't get incorporated into the machinery, and you won't get amplified by it. So then the actually being in the margins is a much better place to be in terms of being able to express oneself clearly and without those filters. But of course, one's in the margins, so then one never gets amplified and never gets heard by anyone who's outside the margins. So then the tonic for that, or the solution to that, seems to me to bring people to the margins. So yeah, then that's what I've been trying to do with the podcast is, and it does require some amplification, of course, but to try and get people onto the podcast who aren't in the margins, but who are willing to come to where I am.
Yeah.
Whereas I won't go to where they are. But if they come to where I am, then that brings more people, and that amplifies the signal in the margin without my having to put filters on it, you know, or compromise. And that's been, I've been a little bit successful. I mean, but what I found is it isn't. And it's an anomaly. It's like Temple Grandin was on the podcast, and she's a mainstream voice.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't the most successful voice. You know, very symbolically, actually, it was a poor signal.
Oh.
So I spoke to her on the cell phone, and the signal wasn't good. So that's kind of a metaphor also that maybe she didn't really fit with the, you know, the marginal context that I created with the podcast. And although I enjoy talking to her, it wasn't as deep and as searching as the conversations usually are, and I try to make them.
Right.
But anyway, she was an anomaly because she's someone in the mainstream. She's autistic, who somehow hasn't been become built up with the armor of, you know, mainstream status. And I just emailed her, and then next thing I know, my phone was ringing, and she's like, "This is Temple Grandin." You know,
yeah.
She wanted to start a conversation right there and then.
Oh, okay.
And that's really unusual. Whereas I found people who are generally people who are a bit more in the mainstream, what they do is, I think they either go through their agent, or even if they don't, they'll go to the website and see how many, basically what your ranking is. They'll do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And if you're not ranked high enough, well, it's not strategic for them to come onto the podcast. So there's that kind of thinking. Once that's operating, those people aren't interesting to me, and I'm not of interest to them, right?
Yeah, I feel the same way. As far as autism, I know when we first connected, that's something that I read about you, and I said, "Oh, my son's diagnosed with autism, and you know, is that anything you want to talk about, or is that kind of gotten bland to address?
No, it never gets bland. Actually, somebody was just emailing me just now about autism and vaccinations, and I was getting annoyed with them because, well, my wife is self-diagnosed autistic, and she's, I would say, more than skeptical about the vaccination autism link. I mean, she thinks
it's
total
settled.
Bullshit.
I thought that was already settled. The latest thing I heard was SSRIs, possibly, but, you know.
That's just what?
The last thing I read was that they're saying women who took SSRIs, like antidepressants, when they were pregnant, had a higher risk of autism. But it's just, I think it's more just smoke and mirrors. I don't think, you know. But go ahead. Your wife was...
I was just referring to that in terms of, I don't know, just something current. And I suppose the whole idea of autism as as brain damage, or even as a disorder of some kind is one I object to, even though, of course, I understand that, and this will be interesting to talk to you as a parent, understand that it can be really challenging, and that there are severe cases of autism, there aren't really any other ways to see it, except as a social disorder, at least.
Right.
But, as you know, my approach is very, very different, and I see it as a different perceptual mode. So I don't even see it as a question of individuals. I see it as a spectrum of perception that we're all on, and not just human beings, but animals and everything are on this perceptual spectrum. And then on the one extreme of the spectrum, you have unfocused awareness, which is just experiencing everything simultaneously and undifferentiated, just kind of without any filters whatsoever. So synesthesia would be a relatively superficial or specific example of that, where all the senses get blurred together and there's no way to distinguish between sights and sounds and smells and tastes and sensations. It's all just one block of information.
Right.
But you could extend that even beyond that in terms of actual physicality, emotions, thoughts, feelings, everything just being happening simultaneously, and even one's perceptions of one's own existence or one's awareness of one's own interior existence and awareness of everything else outside of one. So, I mean, we'd have to kind of, we couldn't even really imagine what this would be like. The closest would be if when we dream, we kind of, our consciousness is not localized to a self, and we're kind of inhabiting the whole world that we're dreaming. And also spiritual descriptions where, you know, the Buddha nature and the Christ consciousness and that sort of thing, the idea that we'd actually become the whole universe, that would be at one end of the spectrum. And then the other end would be the opposite, this incredibly narrow band of awareness, which is often described as a psychopath that is just purely predatorial and objectifies everything, and just like a hammer that sees everything as a nail, that basically is locked into this one very tight, narrow perceptual bandwidth.
Right.
That can only really experience its own wants and needs, and does everything to go about, you know, getting them. So completely isolate and separate on the one hand, and without a self on the other hand, like not really having a separate sense of self on the other end. So that, I mean, that's the spectrum of human perception and human awareness. And I would say it is one way to look at extreme autist, you know, non-functioning autists. If they don't actually have a sense of themselves as a separate being, they don't have a sense of their body as even separate from the world around them, so they can't even manipulate their body. I mean, they say this about babies, because I don't remember, most people don't, that we're not actually in the body when we're first born. Like, it takes a while for the psyche to come all the way into the body, and in fact it probably never does because of trauma and whatnot. But anyway, the actually being fully landed in and identified with the body is something that isn't necessarily the case for all human beings. And I think autists, that's one way of looking at autists, that they're kind of outside their bodies in some way, and hence not able to manipulate their bodies in the way that we do, to the extent most of us, we think we are our bodies. So then, I mean, I'd be interested to hear about your experiences, of course, but there are cases of parents who feel that their children are not even present, that they just seem to be just unaware and just completely disconnected, and just there's nobody home. And but I think that probably most, if not all cases, that's a mistake, and that there is full sentience there, and maybe even deeper levels of sentience than usual, but that it's not able to communicate through the physical, so it can't speak or even make the physical signs of being there, but still there is consciousness there.
Yeah, it's almost like they're on the margins, right? Kind of like the artist thing, and everybody else is in a mainstream way of looking at things. I think that the stigmatization, of mental illness is kind of, people just give up, or in the past they would just give up on people. And so people felt they had no hope, or just they weren't encouraged. Where nowadays, I see as being mentally ill is actually being more self-aware. You know what I mean? And the different degrees of that, dictates how capable you are of living in the world. But I think a lot of it does have to do with, the people who raise you. And, with my son, he was diagnosed at 3. My wife figured there's something not right. And so, that, he's 12 now, but, that was an early age. 3 or 4 to be diagnosed, that's an early age. And he's really...
It's quite pretty common now, I think.
It is.
So what was this? Why was there a feeling that there was something not right?
I didn't think there was anything wrong at first, but my wife is kind of a hypochondriac, so she just, I guess what it was just the fact that he just wasn't being as social as other kids, in his peer group, like at preschool or whatever, or how he would, I guess what they call stimming, like stimulating. Just doing, becoming very fixated on certain behaviors more than normal, and she was right. She picked up on it, and a lot of doctors said he was. I remember one doctor said that he was, said something like he's psychologically disturbed or something that really offended me, and I just walked out. I wasn't. Because to me, that wasn't the end. Like, I was trying to come to terms with what it meant. Because, when you think about having a son, I think everybody kind of identifies with, I'm going to make that son into a better version of me. But then when you hear something like, he has some kind of debilitating factor or a mental illness, you kind of get bummed out. But then, the more time I spent with him and just I focused more energy on him because I knew that he needed it, and he's really turned out to be really intelligent. And his violent, like you said, violent episodes, which he really has got under control. We don't really medicate him. They tell us to, but I don't really believe in it unless he needs it, So medication isn't a factor. It's just love and compassion and encouraging him, like, yeah, that's who you are as a human being. That's okay to be who you are, as long as you don't, break the fundamental laws of nature, like hurt people. You can't hurt people, you can't, do sociopathic things, like you were saying. So I think he's really, like, developed this conscious, and, I'm surprised, that he is where he is, even though they haven't met a school for, like, criminals, because he doesn't like authority. But, that's You know, my wife said, you know, after a couple of years ago, she said, I think you were probably autistic, or you should be autistic too. It's just when I was growing up, there wasn't the, you know, where I lived, there wasn't the system for that. You know, I was just a delinquent criminal child. You know what I mean?
Oh, really?
Yeah, like they just kept throwing me out of school and throwing me in, you know, the youth home for boys, not the youth home, but like, you know, detention hall, stuff like that. So that's where, you know, I was stigmatized by it, which kind of destroyed me. But I, you know, so I see my son and I'm like, I'm not going to, you know, let that happen. So I just try to talk to him as much as possible and not make him feel weird, you know, because mm-hmm. the kids at school do that enough, you know. Which, you know, whole nother story. But yeah, I think that's what happened with you. You kind of learned how to make it work for you and didn't see it as a disability, if, you know, I'm just assuming.
Well, in my case, it was very mild. I mean, I was considered a kind of odd child for sure, but it wasn't a diagnosis happy time back then, at least not in this way, and and generally not for children. And so I was not aware of being socially different as a child or socially challenged, I don't think, but I was aware of having a perceptual quirk, which I seemed to be some sort of disorder, and that, I mean, from pretty young, that I had a difficulty really it's actually very hard for me to talk about that period because I don't really remember it. So,
yeah.
But I do remember that I felt unreal as a kid. Even like I felt that this is not real. What's happening now? And I'm not real. And so I felt like I was kind of living in a dream, and that haunted me quite a bit as a child. And and that isn't specifically a symptom of autism. It's not connected to autism in any way, as far as I know.
Yeah.
It's now diagnosed as depersonalization or derealization, and I think it's probably one symptom of trauma, of being traumatized, of being dissociated. But in any event, I certainly was aware that I was an anomaly, even as a child. Like I didn't feel like I actually really fitted or belonged to my society and my family and what have you.
Right. Now, do you find it hard now to, like, connect with people and have conversations? Like, is that something that's hard for you?
That would depend on the person. So I find it difficult to connect at a superficial level.
Right.
And having said that, I mean, I do and I don't. Like, I do work with, I wouldn't call it work, I volunteer with special needs people. I do once a week or something, teach kind of art class for a small group. And I like going there, and I really like connecting to the, whatever we're going to call these people. I like to call them retards, but it's an affectionate term. Mm-hmm. But anyway, you know, the special needs kid, they call them the clients. And I feel a very, to many of them, I feel a very natural kind of easy connection to them.
Right.
But then with the people who work there, the norms, I don't particularly. And right. So I went there the other day, and they said, you know, one of them said, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. And then I went into the room. Another one said, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. And I went into another room, and another, these are the norms, these are not the, you know, the retards. Yeah. The third one said, how are you? And I was like, everybody keeps asking me that. Why do you keep asking me how I am? And I was just joking, right?
Right.
But actually, I was just expressing something really real, which is, why are you asking me this question? I don't have an answer to how I am. You don't really want to know how I am, right? And that kind of thing, although actually I made a joke of it and I wasn't stressed out, I was actually expressing genuine kind of amusement. So it wasn't difficult for me, but it could have been. Like that whole situation of people asking me how I am when they don't really mean it, it's simply a social norm. That I do find, if it goes on too long, like if I'm in a conversation and the person just keeps, obviously they don't just keep saying how are you, but if they keep on that superficial level and they want to talk on that superficial level, I'll go nuts very quickly. I just won't do it, you know. But generally that doesn't happen because I'll prevent it.
Right. Which I'm sure took a lot of years of, you know, social awkwardness to figure out how to do that, I'm assuming, if you're anything like me.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's about, for me, and I think for anyone, it's about getting more settled in one's body, being more present, being more relaxed just in myself and accepting myself as I am, and then just being able to stay in that. So it's not about learning social ways or learning how to navigate society or any of that. It's right. Although that can be a means to this other end, because right. Society and the world is, I called it the individuation chamber on one podcast. It all of the challenges and the obstacles it prevents for us are because they're reflecting our own internal whatever you want to call that, our own internal disconnect or distortion or trauma or whatever, you know, went wrong in our childhoods that has created this internal defense system of the identity that we're trapped inside. The world is always going to reflect that. So hence, you know, I was talking to James Kunstler the other day about how, I don't know if you noticed this, but in the culture now, particularly in America, there's all this, everything's about people's feelings, and you can't say anything if it's going to hurt people's feelings, and you've got to be politically correct because otherwise the other person might get triggered, and it's a hate crime, or you know, anything is this danger that people will be triggered. Well, that's kind of the point of the world,
right?
You know, we've created this massive distortion of society because of our own internal distortion, and then the distortions in society are there to draw our attention to the internal disorders or whatever so that we can address them. So every time we get triggered by the world or the other, that's an opportunity to see how something's been installed in us that is not us, and to dissolve it through that process of being triggered, being upset, being angry. That's always an opportunity. So I can't remember exactly how I finished that point, just that, you know, being socialized is not really desirable, but learning that actually the ways in which we've been socialized to fit in with the society that is, well, what it is, I don't even want to put a name on it, but it's insane. Let's just call a spade.
Right.
Society is insane, and to actually fit with society, we must become insane. And so, we have to some extent. And so then individuation is actually individuating from the group mind, from the social insanity, and that entails becoming more and more aware of how it encroaches on us and how it oppresses us, and going with that, not going against it. It's like this in between. You don't go along with it,
right?
You can't push against it either, because then it gets stronger. So you follow it inward. Like the distortion outside of us is mirroring a distortion inside us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are part of the insanity. Like, we can always look at the other person and say, well, they're deluded,
right?
But however deluded the other is, we're going to have some equivalent delusion, even if it's not as extreme, and that delusion is more, that's more our business than the other person's delusion, right? The way in which we're distorting our own sense of what's true. That's the thing. I mean, that's what individuation is to do with, is identifying our delusions and how do you do that? I mean, if you're deluded, you don't know that you're deluded. So how do you identify the delusion? Well, it's looking outside of you and seeing the ways in which the world is mirroring that.
Oh, absolutely. I just wanted to let you, go with that on the, you know, go as far as you could with that. Yeah, I think in America, there's just a lot of, there's been a lot of intolerance, and there still is, and there's this campaign to, you know, erase that or, you know, try to make people become more tolerant of each other, which is, you know, a facade, obviously. It's just noise, but yeah, I think that it's just stigmatization of other people, and if somebody doesn't want to be tolerant of other people and doesn't want to look at themselves and improve themselves, then they're really just kind of, they're not making any progress, and what's the point of even interacting with them, you know, like, you know, most people in my town, like my neighbors, and if I try to talk to them, it's pointless, you know. There's just, I see that a lot in people where they're just dead, you know. All they want to talk about is like TV or the weather or just whatever they're into. They're not interested in you or how you're feeling. You know what I mean? They're kind of sealed off. So it's hard to get a culture of people like that to be tolerant and, forgiving of each other. You're accepting.
Well, I think the tolerance thing is a bit of a red herring. I mean, I think tolerance is like a very, very poor substitute for understanding or compassion. It's not even a poor substitute. It's got nothing to do with it. Tolerance is kind of, how do we put this person in a box whereby we don't have to think about them, really?
Yeah.
The whole enforcing of tolerance is itself incredibly intolerant.
Mm-hmm.
As in, you can't tolerate intolerance. I mean, we're supposed to be intolerant to stuff. Like the nervous system itself, or the body, has intolerances. Mm-hmm. And why wouldn't that be true of the psyche? So right. I'm intolerant of lies. I'm intolerant of pretending. Yeah. I'm intolerant of distortion of the truth. And I don't want to become more tolerant of those things. I want to become less tolerant of them. So I'm really intolerant of people who tell me what the right way to think is, even though those people are propagating tolerance. So people tell me that I'm supposed to have certain ideological values around. I'm not even going to mention the specifics because they're too hot buttony, right? But basically, you name it. I mean, any kind of neoliberal value now that I'm supposed to uphold, I'm intolerant of. Not necessarily because I'm intolerant of the minority group that's being tolerated, but I'm tolerant of being told I must tolerate them, that group or that movement or that ideology or that. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm not talking about specifics because it gets, then we get pulled into the specific discussion about whatever it is.
Yeah.
It could be feminism, could be transgender, could be racism.
Political.
You know, yeah. It's so identity politics, really.
Right, right. Yeah, I think with identity, I really like the things that I've heard you say, and we talked about, you know, pseudonyms before through emails, and I forgot what you said about that, but it was really.
Well, I remember, okay, because I remember you use lots of pseudonyms, and I used to, and I remember saying that it's it can be a symptom of trauma. Early trauma. It's this, this desire to constantly keep changing identities or hiding behind identities and not actually be fixed or just identified with one thing, to constantly be hiding, really.
Yeah, or just, I think it was, you said something to the effect that, you know, we're dissatisfied with the identities that you know, the roles that we think we're supposed to play. You know, like who everybody expects us to be, or, you know, who we, just what we think of ourselves, which is what, you know, from what I gather from what you say, is like you really don't think how we perceive ourselves is real, which is not a, you know, unheard of theory, but
no, it isn't.
I think it's fun to play with that, though, and kind of not get too fixated on your identity in society, and, you know, just kind of try to be, you know, not just one person, but just try to tap into that collective consciousness, right? If possible, you know, if there's a way. That's kind of what I try to do. It's almost like, you know, almost like ritual magic where you know, I think it's just toying with people's emotions and making something real out of something that didn't exist in the first place.
What is like ritual magic?
Well, just not exactly, you know, any particular denomination, but, you know, I guess kind of from, I like grew up just interested in like Aleister Crowley or even like Anton LaVey, just like what they were doing, I was just interested in. And, you know, just basically it's almost the same as people say the power of prayer or positive thinking. It's just another spin on that where you just kind of create your reality. You know what I mean? And you will, you know, you will things to happen through symbolism, which could be a pseudonym or, you know, a moniker. You're like changing reality. So the magic is that, you know, you're doing something that most people can't do, if that makes sense.
So what was the part about toying with people's emotions then? Where does that fit in?
Well, because they don't really know who you are, so, you know what I mean? There's no first name basis, you know, there's always this wall that they can't get through, I think. And I think that affects people on an emotional level.
So you're saying this is a desirable thing for you?
No, I think it's just the way I've learned to cope, because I'm such a, you know, like a loner, or just, you know, it's a coping mechanism for me. It might even be kind of a sickness, you know, like I might almost do it to a fault, you know.
Yeah. So, because, you know, I was into Crowley for quite a while. I was never into LaVey. I was always quite anti.
Yeah, I mean
that. But now, I mean, now I would see Crowley as more or less in the same camp, and I mean, it's interesting because I was touching on this already. We're talking about identity politics, and this is this is quite a fresh new insight to me, but the pursuit of happiness, which identity politics is all about, it's basically like, who am I? I want to be able to make my own choices about who I am, basically so I can be happy. And this is supposed to be a kind of unchallengeable value, like how can you challenge, you know, the ideology of pursuit of happiness? Well, right. Actually, the whole American nightmare is built on this idea of pursuing happiness. So,
yeah, manifest destiny.
So absolutely, it does need to be challenged. And what I realize is that the will to power, which, because you mentioned Nietzsche, it is the same. And pursuit of happiness is the will to power, just dressed up in kind of nice domestic sort of clothing. So it seems like something that, you know, Joe Blow and Mrs.
Joneses.
Mrs. Blow can do, you know, and yeah. And it's completely harmless and innocuous and just doesn't need to be questioned. But actually, the will to power is the root of all our suffering, the root of all evil, I would even say, is the will to power.
Mm-hmm.
It really does tie in with Crowley and the occult thing, which I was into for many years. I never got ritualistic. Well, once I did, but mostly I didn't. I just felt I didn't adhere to chaos magic. I didn't read the books or anything, but essentially like chaos magician, or even they did more rituals than I did. I was like a fool rather than the magician. But
right.
I learned all this, the symbolism, and I even thought I was, I don't know if I thought it was a reincarnation of Crowley, but I thought I knew I had known him in a past life. I went pretty deep in terms of, you could say, a kind of psychosis or ego inflation around that. I was convinced I was the avatar of Lucifer, not the, but a, because I wasn't that far gone. I understood that Lucifer was too big for any single body to, incarnate through.
Right.
But I thought that I was one of the bodies that Lucifer was incarnating in, and I had, you know, visions and dreams and waking experiences that confirmed that. But now, looking back over that time and with what I've learned since then, although I still think the idea that Lucifer might be some kind of egregore or archetypal intelligence that could possess, a psyche, I still allow for that possibility. I tend to think that what was going on was more to do with trauma and disowned fragments of my psyche, you know, that got broken off and that became powerful in their own sort of isolated realm.
Mm-hmm.
Like, better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. And that is the Lucifer archetype, I think. It's a fragment of God that takes control of its own petty domain and feels like it's God. So something like that. And so there was a fragment of me that felt incredibly powerful, maybe the one that had identified with the abuser. And so then when that was, when I thought that Lucifer was taking over my life and I was becoming a god, it was that trauma fragment that had identified with my abuser, whoever that was, I don't know, that was taking me over.
Right.
So, and I think that the will to power and occultism is really wrapped up in this, is that we have this, and not just individually, but collectively, this, the psychological trauma of abuse that instills us with this pathological will to power, to become powerful. And the only way to do that is by identifying with the part of us that fragmented when we were abused and that identified with the abuser. So it's one and the same with the internal persecutory mechanism, where we persecute ourselves. So people who are constantly tormenting themselves, saying you're no good, you're shit, you're dirt, you're scum, whatever the dialogue is, they're also driven to prove that wrong, and they're the people who are most possessed by the will to power, paradoxically, right. I think, the ones who are self-punishing.
Right.
And so then they become tormentors themselves. If they get the power, then they will use that power to abuse others.
So that's pretty existential, like it sounds to me.
In what way?
Well, just the taking, the responsibility of, like, you are what you do, as you know, from what I understand of it, which is not as much as I want.
What do you mean it's not as much as you want?
I feel like there's a lot, you know, I wouldn't even call myself an existentialist, but it's very appealing to me, you know, the concepts of it. And, you know, I think it's something that you're probably more versed in than I am.
Not really. I mean, I the existentialist thing I understand and I guess agree with to a certain extent in that what we are intrinsically, we need to bring from the inside to the outside. So we need to express it through our actions in order to know what we are.
Yeah.
So in that sense, yes, I am. Who am I right now? I am this expression. That's it.
Right.
But not in the sense of that I am just the sum of my actions. I don't know if that's part of existentialism, because I would say that the sum of my actions, well, the majority of my actions have been driven by trauma and by conditioning, and so they're not who I am, right? So there's a bit of a paradox there. It's like the Matrix can't tell you who you are, that thing, right?
Yeah, well, it's kind of dependent on your environment, right? I mean, a lot of our actions are, you know, if we weren't here in this environment with in this, you know, society of people, you know, would we do what we do, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
It's like that consciousness that you talk about, that like that the mass consciousness.
Well, not the mass consciousness. I mean, I was talking about the undifferentiated, which is beyond even the collective. That's awareness as the substance or the context of everything that is. So I don't know how to put it, because I don't want to say everything is aware, but everything is awareness. Like everything, all that we know for sure is awareness. Like all you know for sure that you are is awareness.
Yeah.
All I know for sure that I am is awareness. So everything outside of me may be inside of me. So I can look at a tree as I am now, or houses, or what have you. I don't know that they're aware, but I don't even know that they exist outside of me. So they're actually part of my awareness. So then, if all we know is awareness, then in a sense, all there is awareness. And so that's what I mean by the non-focused awareness is that we're in everything, and everything is in us. So,
yeah.
But the mass mind is something else, because that's like a system within the larger system that is kind of arbitrary. Like you were saying, if we were born in a different environment, we would be different. We'd experience ourselves completely differently.
Right.
And yet, we're an environment, a social environment, in which all the different components have kind of identified together as one thing, humanity, and created a value system out of that experience that is kind of self-contained and self-referencing. So ideology, belief, whatever you want to call that's the mass mind that actually believes and good and evil, for starters. Yeah,
I see.
Beliefs, all the things that we take for granted, right?
Right.
And that's constantly being reinforced every time we have a conversation, because it's in our language, but
sure.
Every time you go out on the street and you interact with people, there are underlying values that are being reinforced and aren't being questioned, but that aren't empirically true or aren't inherently true, like the pursuit of happiness thing, or that you or I exist as a person, as opposed to a body that's aware in an environment, which is different than being a person.
Right.
Because a person, that's identity policies, you know, I make choices, I have preferences, that's conditioned in us through the mass, the collective.
Consciousness.
Except
animals don't have consciousness, some would say.
Well, they do have consciousness, but it's not... I think of my cat as a person.
Right.
Because he has a lot of personality. So he very clearly is an individual.
Sure.
But But that's partly because, or largely even because, he's an aspect of me, or I'm an aspect of him. Like, we came into this world together, not literally. I was born long before he was, but there's some symbiotic connection there, like you would have with your son, whereby we're part of a single system. And so, insofar as I see myself as a person, I see him as a person. He's definitely conscious. I'm definitely conscious.
Maybe it's ego. Ego that divides.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't think of my cat having an ego,
right,
really.
Right.
Whereas I know I do have an ego.
Right.
So what is that? Like, ego is just a word. It's to do with the defense system. Like, I built up a defense system whereby I would define myself against what I don't like, essentially. Good and evil. Like, what's the fruit of good and evil? It's when we're raised as children, we're told, well done, you did good. Bad, you did, that was wrong.
Yeah, conditioning. You know,
that early conditioning is essentially reward and punishment. That's the fruit of good and evil, and it's arbitrary. You know, our parents don't know good and evil. They don't know the difference between good and evil. No one does. It's it's not knowable, right? 'Cause it isn't. It's not like day and night. And even the difference between day and night isn't clear, because there's twilight. So
yeah.
It's not even as fixed, as definable as day and night, good and evil. It's arbitrary. It depends on the circumstances. And yet we're told as children very early on about this is bad, per se. You know, at least that's how we receive it. And not only this is bad, we are bad for doing it. So back to that existential thing. You know, we do something that's just a natural expression or response to our environment. We're told it's bad, and then we're made to somehow feel that we are bad because we did something that is seen by bad as our gods, you know, our parental overlords.
Right, right.
That was kind of a riff, actually. I'm not sure where I was going with that, but I think it's interesting, probably true. Dusty summer, horse race, a dirty number, dirty spells. I put them under, and lock the door in the concrete cell. I lock the door in the concrete cell. I'm not afraid.
So you don't have kids? Don't you're not gonna have kids? Is that something?
Doesn't look like it. I think I missed the boat on that one. And
Well, that's probably allowed you to do what you do, you know, to be able to travel and well, you've been to what, Morocco and Mexico? Is that all true?
Guatemala, France, Spain.
All over the place, yeah.
Yeah, I've traveled the world. That, but also, like I guess I wouldn't be able to examine myself so closely if I had a child. Not that, of course, if you have a child, they force you to see things about yourself you don't want to see just as a partner, but
Yeah.
you don't necessarily realize that it's you that you're seeing, right?
And they hold a mirror right up to you know,
Yeah.
as they grow up.
Yeah.
Which, you know, people can choose to acknowledge, or they can just kind of sink further into, you know, despair about themselves, you know, but I think it's a good thing. But yeah, it definitely tethers you, having kids. But
You just have one son,
no, I have a daughter as well. You know, she's 9 or 10, and she's like, you know, starting to develop that ego, and I'm really watching that fester, because she turned into this like sweet like princess, and now she's, you know, I watch that slowly go away just because the people she's surrounded by, you know. And, you know, I also have a stepson who's like, you know, about to go to college, who, you know, so I've kind of, with parenting, I've dealt with it all. You know, the autistic, or the, you know, mental stigmatization, and I have a daughter and a stepson, and being married. And how long have you been married? I've been married 13 years, so.
Half that.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that's really something that you can't explain to people. You know, people say marriage is tough or don't get married, but it's a personal exploration and discovery, really, you know,
Yeah.
which is why it's so hard.
I think it's another example of how we're misled by the culture and the ideology, because you get this idea of marriage that is completely false. I mean, it can't be represented. I mean, there are people that are married that you know, maybe they can tell you about it, but they probably won't in most cases.
Yeah, they never did. When I was growing up, nobody told me.
Right. And then you get, of course, the movies, and they, well, to some extent, they represent it. I mean, they tend to show marriages as sort of cold and functioning and
Right.
distant. But I don't think if they show that, they don't show that there's a meaning to that also. There's a meaning to a kind of surface distance and a familiarity and even a coldness that creeps into most marriages, where you're having to go into deeper parts of connecting that aren't on the surface, because you can't just bullshit once you've been married for a few years. You can't just be romantic, because the romance dies pretty fast, because
Right.
it was never really real to begin with. So, and then you're left with somebody who's basically in your space the
Yeah,
whole time.
judging you and, you know, pointing out everything that you do wrong.
Well, potentially. Hopefully, it's not all that. I try not to do that, because I mean, I'm more aware of doing that myself than the other doing it. But it's both. Yeah, it's absolutely both. So the blame, the culture of blame. But anyway, yeah, I think the thing about marriage that has probably been more or less lost in our culture is the whole point of it is its commitment. Its commitment to no matter what, right? That's the idea of it. And what is that? Is it like, well, just because I made a decision, I can't go back on it? No, it's to do with the surrender. Like, what kind of opportunity are we ever going to be in to completely surrender to unpleasant circumstances. Well, generally, I mean, you might, of course, millions of people are in those circumstances, but they don't see them as that.
Right.
Like if you're a slave, or you've got a wage slave, or you're in a war-torn country, and basically you're just fighting to survive. Whereas a marriage, you choose that, you think this is what I want. It turns out that it's harder than Beirut, you know, it's harder than being in Iraq in the 20th century kind of thing. Not that I've been there. And yet it's where you want to be. Like, you don't just want to bail out because you're committed. And so the temptation is to say, at some point, I made a mistake, this is the wrong person for me. And more people say it. It's more and more condoned to say that. Oh yeah, they're not valuing you, they're not meeting your needs, look somewhere else. Well, the point of marriage, I think, is that you can't get your needs met, right? The other can never meet those needs, so you get to find that out, and then you get to be in the needs being unmet, and the distress of that. That's the incubation, you know, the individuation chamber in miniature, I think.
Yeah, it's very humbling, you know.
It's
like that could be, you know, your spouse could be your god, you know what I mean? Like, literally, if you have nothing else to replace that, you know?
Well, I wouldn't see it as the spouse, I'd see it as the situation.
Or the institution of the marriage.
The marriage, and not, of course, I don't believe in institutions, but it's the commitment. Like, it's, you know, some, I mean, in my case, like, my wife and I met more or less in the context of individuation. Like, we were met online and we were exploring psychology and patterns and past trauma, and so that was kind of the underlying reason behind our coming together, was to individuate. So that was the basis of our marriage, and so that's always been in sight for me, which is very helpful. That's what I'm surrendering to, or trying to every day, is my agreement, my commitment to individuate.
Yeah, I understand.
Which is to do with pulling in all the external needs to the inside, like following all the external needs to the unmet need within, like the original wound, really. The original wound, and actually going all the way into and through the original wound to the psyche that was wounded, the wholeness. Because if there's a wound, then there's something that's been wounded. If there's a fracture, then there's a hole that was fractured.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
Alright, that's the end of that podcast. It's the last podcast of 2015. Thank you to you donators, Kyron, John, Mark, and Elizabeth again. That's really very greatly appreciated. There's some discussion about Alistair Crowley and his involvement in sexual child abuse at the blog, which might interest some listeners, I'm sure. I don't know if I'll get to podcast about that. I maybe see if I can find a Crowley expert who's willing to talk about that. I don't have any guests lined up for 2016 at all. Well, I think there's one or maybe two that are pending, sort of provisionally set up, maybe three, but generally no ideas, no clues. I feel like things have just ground down as they tend to at the end of the year, so I'm hoping that there will be a renewal with 2016. But you, yes, that's you, the listener, can be more than just a listener and participate. Send me some leads to follow that hopefully will bear fruit, that you will get to partake of. Okay, thanks again, and till next time.
soul. The monkeys boo when his world came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey, and monkey's lips is mine. Here comes the monkey, and monkey's lips is mine.